The following recording, produced by the LA Sound Posse, was a talk given by Professor Cynthia Enloe on November 10th of 2004 at the Interdisciplinary Humanities Center of the University of California at Santa Barbara. Her talk was titled, Launching Wars, Counting Votes, and Investigating Masculinities, Feminist Post-Election Insights.
Thank you so much for coming. We're going to start. For those of you who are still in the hallways, if you come in, there's a little bit of room on the floor. I'm sorry that the corridors are so cramped. Cynthia Enloe is currently a research professor in the International Development, Community, and Environmental Department at Clark University, and one of the most brilliant scholars of our time on matters of gender militarization and development. Her feminist teaching and research have focused on the interplay of women's politics in the national and international arenas, with special attention to how women's labor is made cheap in globalized factories, how women's emotional and physical labor has been used to support governments' war-waging policies, and how many women have tried to resist both of these efforts. Her work has had a profound and inspirational impact on my own thinking, and I think that generations of other scholars throughout the world would certainly make the same claim. Her 9 books include her most recent title, The Curious Feminist, printed just last week by University of California Press. Professor Sabine Frühstück of the Department of East Asian Languages and Cultural Studies played a leading role in bringing Professor Enloe here to campus. And Sabine and I also thank the Interdisciplinary Humanities Center, the Center for the Study of Sexual Minorities in the Military, the Cold War Center, the Department of Sociology, the East Asia Center, the Hull Chair of Women's Studies, the Women's Studies Program, and the Military and Society Faculty Reading Group. With no further delay, please help me in extending a very warm welcome to Professor Cynthia Enloe.
I guess you heard that this is kind of a faux mic. You know, it is really intended for the LA Radio Posse. I never heard about that either. Anyway, but they're here in the room, right there. And they're on the web, right? The LA Sound Posse. The LA Sound Posse.org, I hear. Anyway, so can everyone hear me without a real mic? Because I'm a kind of meanderer. Yeah, but that means that I'm stuck at a podium, and we 5'2" types, we hate podiums. Wow. Okay. But at various points, I will not be able to stand still. I mean, you know, I mean, don't you find that it's awful to be stuck standing still? I mean, politically, intellectually, right, physically. So we'll do both and hope that I don't become too delinquent. I'm really delighted to be here at UCSB. This is, I think, my second or third time maybe here, but I haven't been back for maybe 4 or 5 years, so I'm delighted to be here again, and I really want to thank Aaron, where's Aaron? Right there. Aaron and Sabine for doing so much of the work. I'll talk for a bit, but then I would really love it for my own sake, too, to open it up for comments and questions. And what I thought it might be useful to do, what is this, November 10th, 8 days later, is to really talk about voting, masculinity, femininity, and war. But then add onto war militarization. Now, that's a mouthful. And I'll come back to what I mean about militarization, because most militarization happens when a country is not at war. In fact, militarization makes it possible for a government to convince most of its people that going to war makes sense. So militarization is an idea that over the years I've found very useful, and here's what I mean by it. I mean, and you'll notice that it's a process. It's one of those ization words. Like in your courses, what other ization words are you forced to learn about and think about and be able to use? What's another ization word that comes? Globalization. I hear you even have a globalization studies major. You're so hip. But globalization means something is happening over time, right? It's not a thing. It's a process. What's another ization that you all have to, that you all have to absorb and be able to use? What else? Socialization, absolutely, that happens to you personally. For instance, if you go to law school, right? One of the biggest socialization machines the world has ever invented, you know, to turn you into somebody who thinks it's normal to think like a lawyer, right? Right? But that's a socialization process, right? What's another ization? Dollarization, absolutely, where the dollar currency is imagined to be the most useful currency, the most valuable currency. But then there's urbanization and industrialization, right? Now the thing is, militarization then is something you should think about the way you think of globalization or socialization or industrialization. That is, it is something that happens to people, to towns, to universities, to whole institutions, and to entire societies over time. It is a creeping kind of process. So, for instance, one of the things that I'm keeping track of these days is when did camouflage outfits turn up in the J. Crew catalog? Well, when did they? When was the first time in a J. Crew catalog, which I know some of you know something about, right? I mean, I know where I am here, right? When do you think that camouflage apparel turned up for the first time in a J. Crew catalog? Have you kept an eye on this?
91.
This year. Now, it began turning up in other places in Gulf War I, right? You know, the gray, white, black camo, right, which was supposed to mimic the Saudi environment. But the new camo that has appeared in J. Crew has just happened this year. And I wanted to know, this is militarization. This is the militarization not only of J. Crew, and that's what I really think of it as. That is, there is something about the people who run J. Crew who had never before, but do now, think that camouflage attire is saleable, is fashionable, and somehow is J. Crew-ish in a way that they had never thought about it before. And your point about in 1990-91, camouflage attire began appearing in other retail venues, in other catalogs, but not in J. Crew. So what, you have to imagine, you're all at a board meeting of J. Crew designing next year's, not just catalog, next year's contracting out of the making of J. Crew apparel. And somebody for the first time says, let's market at least one style of camouflage pants. And then you have to imagine what the discussion around the J. Crew table is, about whether that's fashionable, about whether it's saleable, about whether it's encouraging a kind of values that maybe J. Crew in the past has never wanted to associate itself with. But that is exactly, that teeny tiny little setting, the J. Crew marketing crowd sitting around the table trying to decide that whether now is the first time they should introduce camouflage, and should they just introduce it on the men's pages or on the women's pages too? And which kind of model should they have wearing it? That is where militarization takes place. It also takes place every time a university decides whether, in fact, the Defense Department and or perhaps the Department of Energy, militarization happens in a lot of places that don't look like the Pentagon. Every time a university decides that its research agenda, its research funding agenda, how it pulls in research money, which every serious university now thinks about a lot, to what extent do they think that going after Defense Department money and or militarized energy research project money is good for the university? Every time a high school decides to adopt junior ROTC, how many of you went to high schools that when you were in that high school, it had junior ROTC? Okay, everybody look around so you have an idea. Name some of the schools. Okay? Yeah. Oh, it's news to somebody. Yeah? Santa Ana? What else? In New Hampshire, absolutely, right up the road from me. In Texas, absolutely, Clark High School in Texas. Any others? In West Virginia? Oak Grove High School in the Bay Area? Okay, now listen. Every time you see a junior ROTC program in a high school, there has been a debate in the school committee and amongst parents and unofficially amongst teachers and maybe amongst students as to whether that's a good thing for high schools. That is, every time you see a junior ROTC program, it didn't exist for a long time. You're seeing decision making, and you're seeing decision making about what is good for young people, what is good for a public institution, what is good, and this is oftentimes the way junior ROTC is sold by the Pentagon to a high school, what is good for parenting? That is, does the introduction of junior ROTC into a particular high school, will that help mothers and fathers carry out what they think of as responsible parenting? That's the militarization of parenting. That's not just the militarization of a particular high school. That's the militarization of what it means to bring discipline, in quotes, to the years of one's adolescence. And if you're looking for a senior thesis project or a master's project or a PhD project or a faculty project that is certain to get you tenure, go and pick a high school that has adopted junior ROTC, and then go and pick a high school that is close by that has had the same discussion and has not adopted junior ROTC, and compare them. And compare them thinking about what convinces parents and principals. Teachers usually don't get the vote in this. What convinces mothers and fathers and principals and supervisors and elected members of the school committee that adopting a military program for 15, 16, 17, and 18-year-olds is a good thing? One of the reasons that the United States government has been amongst the minority that has not signed on to the International Convention for the Rights of the Child. That's just like the Landmines Treaty, for instance, other treaties. This is called the UN Convention on the Rights of the Child. And it has to be approved, like all treaties, by the US Senate as well as signed on to by the sitting president. And one of the reasons that the United States has not signed on to the UN Convention for the Rights of the Child is that in that convention, which was written in part to try and stem the flow of child soldiers in particularly places like Sierra Leone, Liberia, the Congo, but out of that inspiration, there is a line in there that says that any government that signs on to the UN Convention for the Rights of the Child may not recruit any child under the age of 18 into the government's military. Which government do you think does not want to agree to that? Amongst others is the United States government. That would look as though it was really a cramp on the US military's junior ROTC recruitment program. So militarization takes a lot of forms. It's junior ROTC, it's university research strategies, it is J.Crew catalogs. Now, what I've been really interested in is how has the recent election got militarized? Here's what I really want to think through then. To what extent was the campaign in the current U.S. presidential election militarized? And I don't want to look just at the campaign itself, that is, at the way in which the Bush handlers presented Bush or the ways in which the Kerry handlers presented Kerry. My guess is that all of you could do a really pretty good job on what was militarized about the campaign strategist's thinking about how to persuade us as voters. What I'm really interested in is what did it do to voters? What did it do to individuals thinking like a voter? Now, I want to step back from this for a minute and think about voting and war. You know, various groups of citizens, well, various groups of members of a society have gotten the right to vote at different times. How many of you have had some occasion, either in high school or at university, to study in some course or other how women won the right to vote in at least some country? How many of you have found that, right? When I was in college, and also when I was at Berkeley when it was radical Berkeley, well, it wasn't so radical, actually. I was there in the 60s, but in fact, we never talked about, nobody ever thought that we should learn how women in different countries, including the U.S., ever won the right to vote. I mean, it's astounding now when I think of all I didn't learn in both my undergraduate and my graduate years. But here's one of the things I've now started thinking about when I'm trying to, you know, belatedly catch up on the history of who got the vote when in every country. And by the way, it has to do with working class men as versus property owning men. It has to do with race and ethnicity as who's defined as capable of thinking in a fashion that would allow one to vote reasonably. Listen to how loaded that is, right? And it has to do with who is accorded citizenship under what conditions. So voting is very, very contentious. And that means it's got a history. And anything that has a history is worth studying because you can see who made what decisions, when, and why. Nothing is normal. If there's one thing that I've learned by belatedly becoming a feminist, is that anytime somebody uses the word natural or normal, mentally, or sometimes if you can in graffiti, put quotations around it. Because somebody is trying to persuade us, if they say something's natural or normal, they're trying to persuade us that nobody ever made a decision about it. That is, they're trying to persuade us that that thing that is natural, whether it be a certain kind of marriage or who can vote and who can't vote, they're trying to persuade us that that thing that they call natural never had any power wielded to institute it. That no decision was ever made in real time. And that's a very dangerous thing to be encouraged to think, right? Because it really depoliticizes one's own notion of how one got to where one is in whatever society you're living in. So belatedly, I'm trying to figure out how war affected the arguments for and against women getting the right to vote. And here's how it's looked in a couple of countries. In Mexico, the Revolutionary War in Mexico, as many of you know, was a very costly, bloody struggle from 1910 to 1917. And many of you, I know, study Mexican history, and you know that the consequences of how that war was fought in Mexico from 1910 to 1917 is still very much part of Mexican contemporary politics. But one of the things that came out of that was a constitutional convention held in Mexico City in 1917. And it was to write a new constitution for how to reorganize what constitutions are. They're not for lawyers. Constitutions are the blueprint of how you distribute power. Everybody should be interested in everybody's constitution. Watch the United States government trying to have an influence over the Iraqi new constitution. Watch the United States government trying to have an influence over the new Afghan constitution. Why do governments care, and why should all of us care? Because they are blueprints for the distribution of power. That's what a constitution is. Well, in 1917, the Mexican party elites who came together to write the Constitution decided that Mexican women who had been so active in the war and winning the revolution, it was decided by those mainly male elite politicos in 1917 that women really could not be trusted with the vote. And the main reasoning was that the Revolutionary War, you have to think about war now, the Revolutionary War was fought at least in part to undo the power of the Catholic clergy in Mexican political life. And what was imagined by these male political leaders who had lots of differences with each other, but one of the things they imagined was you couldn't trust Mexican women because they were under the thumb Of whom? The priests. So it was imagined that if you denied women, Mexican women, the right to vote, what you would be able to do is at least take away some of the power of the local priests. Now let's move to the United States. One of the crucial events in women's waging the right to vote movement in the United States was World War I. And a decision had to be made by suffrage activists. And this was true in Britain at the same time as in the United States. One of the decisions was, now you have to think of yourself as a suffrage strategist, right? You have been waging a campaign. I don't know how long you all have been active in whatever movements you've been active in, but imagine being active in the campaign for 40 years. That takes a lot of stamina. So here they are, they've been waging a campaign for over 30, 35 years, and here comes World War I, and the suffragists in both Britain and in the United States, here's the decision they had to make. It was a strategic decision, but it's a decision about whether you're going to militarize the right of women to vote. And this was, here's the debate. Now you're all suffrage strategists. This is 1917 in the US or 1914 in Britain. And here's your decision. Should you throw all the weight of your very considerable social movement behind the government's efforts to wage war so that you can convince the general public as well as the political elites that women's contribution to national security is invaluable? In fact, you're going to prove yourself by supporting the war effort, you're going to prove yourself as women so invaluable that nobody after the war can imagine that you should be continued to be treated like second-class citizens. Now, Matt, what do you think the other side of the debate is going to sound like? Now, you're a women's suffrage activist, which included both men and women. The other side of the debate was, if we cast our considerable energies towards the government in waging its war, will we in fact just be confirming the power of a, not just men, but of a masculinized way of solving international problems? Will we in fact maybe win the vote by showing ourselves so valuable in wartime, but at what cost? At what cost that will last for generations? That the only way that women can prove themselves first-class citizens is to show themselves as invaluable to a war-waging government? Is that the only basis on which women can claim to be first-class citizens? That's a legacy you won't live down for a long time. And in fact, the suffrage movements in the United States and in Britain split right down the middle on this. In both countries, yes, women did win the vote from all male legislatures right after the war. But that's what the lesson looks like. It looks as though women prove themselves to be valuable to war-waging governments, and therefore, now notice how narrow the therefore is. Therefore, they deserve the right to be treated as first-class citizens. That's the only basis for being a first-class citizen? To show yourself valuable to a war-waging government? Look out. Now, Kuwaiti women are the ones who are now trying to figure this same equation out, right? We all need to know more. I'm not saying that I've always known this. I mean, I'm just amazed at how much I have to learn kind of every week just to catch up. Well, I never knew that there was a women's suffrage movement, an organized women's suffrage movement in contemporary Kuwait. I mean, maybe some of you have studied this and you're way ahead of me. I hope so. Be awful to think that, you know, none of us know this. But I never heard about this until Gulf War I, that is, the war of 1990-1991. And for the first time, friends of mine who work with women in Kuwait began to say, you know, Cynthia, get up to speed on this. There had been a very effective Kuwaiti women's suffrage movement in Kuwait. They had had a very hard time persuading the emir and the male masculinized political elite, not all Kuwaiti men are elites, that women deserved the right to vote and could be trusted with it. And here's what happened. When the Iraqi military occupied Kuwait, and you probably have heard stories about this, but many Kuwaiti women risked all to try and subvert that occupation. Some of them, for instance, took in Filipina maids and hid them. A lot of Filipinas work as domestic workers in Kuwait. Some of them tried to disrupt the communication lines and the supply lines of the Iraqi forces that were occupying Kuwait. And when they came out of that war, that is by March, April, May of 1991, those Kuwaiti women said to the emir and to Kuwaiti elite men, okay, now mind you, this makes Kuwaiti women activists strategically very much like the British and the Americans before them. It doesn't make them exotic or different. It means that they too said to the Kuwaiti men they had to persuade, look at the contributions we as women made to resisting the foreign occupation. Don't we deserve, haven't we proved that we are contributors to the nation, that we actually have the attributes, the courage, the adult rationality to vote? And in fact, they still don't have the vote. But that claim, and the suffrage movement still exists in Kuwait, and keep an eye on it. It's a very savvy movement. But that claim is a claim that militarizes women's right to vote. So voting can be both gendered, that is, voting is masculinized insofar as it's imagined to go along with a kind of masculinized notion of rationality and public life. One of the main arguments that has been used in virtually every country that has denied women the right to vote is the following: that women are primarily domestic creatures, that they're good at being wives and they're good at being mothers, but you know, public life is too rough and tumble for any creature who is feminine. This is all about the politics of femininity. And therefore, women should leave public life to men. So that's argument number one. Argument number two, these have been very powerful arguments, and they have not totally gone away even when women have on the books won the right to vote. Argument number two, thinking rationally is a masculinized way of using one's brain. That what feminine people are good at is emotional caring. In fact, sometimes they're even better at it. This is a very generous kind of, you know, nod. That they're even better at it sometimes than masculine people. But rationality, you know, that's very, as they say, hard-nosed. That requires a kind of mental toughness, a kind of logic that really isn't very, what do you think the word follows? Natural for people who are feminine. This is why today all the arguments about women in science, they are really a continuation of, in fact, those anti-suffrage arguments. And the third argument is that women really don't need to vote because their fathers and their husbands have their best interests at heart. In fact, they probably know women and girls' interests better than they do, and therefore will vote on their behalves. That's the notion of the protector. And this is a very powerful notion that creeps into the politics of security. Now think about the Karl Rove, that's the main campaign strategist for George Bush. Now think of the notion of the security mom, right? Have any of you heard about the security mom, sort of a cartoon version of a woman voter? Well, when I heard the security mom term begin to crop up in this recent US election, I began to actually think about that anti-suffrage claim, the claim that, in fact, one of the crucial attributes of being feminine is not only needing to be protected, but wanting to be protected. That is, the protector is allegedly a man, not only a man, but a masculine man, right? This is around questions of homophobia and so on. A masculine man, and the quintessential protected is somebody who's feminized. And the idea is that somebody who is feminized not only needs to be protected, but actually takes great reassurance in being protected. Now think about security moms. You notice what was missing in the campaign. There were no security dads. Think about that. Because a security dad is supposed to be the protector. The security mom is the one who is allegedly so convinced, internalized the idea that she needs protection, that she's going to make her voter choice in 2004 United States based on who she thinks can best protect her. That's a pretty passive notion of being a voter. But it's a very militarized notion of what attribute should be prioritized by feminized voters. Now, I'm going to move away. Don't tell the posse. Okay. I've got a couple of figures here from the joint exit polling that was done by the Edison Group for CNN, ABC, CBS, NBC, all of them, you know, this year combined and had a single exit polling outfit that they contracted to do exit polling on Election Day, right? So we have now one, if you will, grand exit polling compilation. And let me give you some of the figures that really struck me. I'll give you some of the more conventional figures first, and I know it's really hard to hear figures, so I'll come back to them, so don't think you just have to remember all the numbers. Of all the people in the United States who voted 8 days ago, of all the people who voted, 46% were men and 54% were women. Kind of interesting gap there, right? But let me move on a little bit. Of all the women who voted, now you have to, in your mind's eye, picture all the women in the United States who voted 8 days ago, okay? Think of all the women who voted. Don't think of men at all here. Think of all the women who voted. Of all the women who voted, 48% voted for Bush. Now think of all the men, okay? The women now walk off stage. Now all the guys come on stage. Think of all the men who voted 8 days ago. Okay, got it? All the men who voted 8 days ago. 55% voted for Bush. That's about a 7%, what some people would call a gender gap. Okay? But I don't think this is the most interesting stuff. Here's what began to jump out at me when I began to, I'm not really a number crunching kind of girl. But, you know, sometimes it's good to, and then I have to say, I find that if I say a whole sentence about a number, the number makes sense to me. Whereas I can't just look at the number and have it make sense. I've got to actually put it in real language. So let me give you the next set in whole sentences. This is about marriage and voting. And what does marriage do to women's voting in a time that its government calls wartime? Now, you'll notice that phrase I use because I actually think it's dangerous to define the time we're living in as wartime. I put war on terror in quotes all the time. I put wartime in quotes because if you naturalize, if you don't put it in quotes, if you just take as unproblematic, as not to be debated or questioned, this is wartime. We are in a state of war. We are currently waging a war on terror. If you don't put those in quotes, if you take those as a given, you then actually rearrange all kinds of priorities, all kinds of notions about secrecy, security, power, and citizenship. So, but this makes me think about marriage and women and voting in a time when at least one of the parties, well, actually both of the parties in this last presidential election called wartime. Okay, now the stage is blank again. Call back on stage just married women. Okay, so on to stage comes all married women who voted. All married women who voted. Of all married women who voted, 55% of them voted for Bush. Of all married women who voted 8 days ago, 55% voted for Bush, And of all those women on stage who are married, 44% voted for Kerry. Off they go, off stage to the green room or wherever they go off stage. And now let's call on to stage all the not married women who voted. Now, you'll notice the term I'm using is not married. Not married means you could be never married, you could be divorced, not currently married, or you could be widowed. Right? So not married is a quite diverse category. But you have on stage all the women who are not married who voted 8 days ago. Of all the not married women who voted, almost the reverse pattern, 58% voted for Kerry. Remember, of the married women, 44% voted. 58 for Kerry. Of the not married women, 58% voted for Kerry. Of the not married women, only 40% voted for Bush. What does this have to do with militarization? First of all, what happens to women when they get married? truly, what happens? You can imagine, well, you imagine. What do you think helps explain this? Because that means there is an 18% gap between amongst not married women, 40% for Bush, 58% for Kerry. That's one of the biggest, in all that exit polling demographics, that's one of the biggest gaps, 18%. And between married women and unmarried women, it's a 15% gap. That's pretty interesting. Huh? What do you think helped explain that? Yeah, what do you think? And I'll repeat it so we can hear it in the mic.
Married women are more likely than divorced women to have children. And married women are women that were once married and not divorced and be older, so their kids are probably older than 5 years. Mm-hmm. And unmarried women don't have anything to worry about.
So you think that the kid factor, right, might be the thing that affects whether the security mom pitch, I use the word pitch, I don't want to just demean it because I actually take it quite seriously, and I would say the same thing about the Kerry campaign having various pitches. So that the security mom message that somehow has, well, it's the mom part, isn't it, right? That it somehow particularly has a resonance because what does it do? It plays on the notion that the woman who's going into the voting booth will prioritize her identity as a mother who may need the protection of a masculinized government, but in her everyday life sees her as a protector of her child. This is the politics of national security. I don't know what you all think of national security. You might think about, should we buy the next missile defense system, right? Or should the Defense Department collapse the difference between the armed services so the Navy doesn't compete so much with the Army? You may have a lot of thoughts about national defense. What I'm arguing here is how a woman imagines herself as a woman who has children when she walks into a voting booth during an election where both candidates have tried to convince her that she's living in a wartime, that is the politics of national defense and national security. What else do you think might explain? I'm not asking this rhetorically. I don't think we have any idea yet as to what is going on here between married and not married women when they had this kind of two militarized candidates trying to compete for her allegiance. What else do you think may have gone on? What do you think? And again, I'll repeat it.
Non-married women also might have children.
So absolutely.
That argument totally holds.
Yeah.
I was thinking that when women get married, often they make compromises. They become much more influenced by their husbands. And so they vote with their husbands. And, so they lose their independent judgment.
Yeah. It may very well be that there's something going on, right, between people who think of themselves as wives and people who think of themselves as husbands. That may be, that is, we're talking about heterosexual marriages now. Remember, I'm from Massachusetts, right? So we don't just talk about marriages if we know what marriage is anymore. Also, I was just up in Canada By the way, I have to tell you, the Canadians are absolutely alarmed at what's going on to their South, right? And there's just a sidebar. Since we never, do you follow BC, British Columbia politics? Is that kind of really on your radar? You kind of think, oh gosh, who's in power in BC? No, right? Here's what the Canadians are worried about. They are worried, it's going to come back to marriage, they are worried that the now newly reelected Bush administration is going to pressure the Canadian government to adopt the missile defense system that the Canadians have been trying not to adopt. And the language is going to be the language of masculinity. This is now me talking. The first part was the Canadians, now it's me, right? Because when I was having discussions up there, I said, being from the South, I said, look out, dear Canadians, because the pressure that is going to be put on you is the pressure that the United States government, both Republicans and Democrats, put on the Japanese as well. And that is this, and here's the language. If you don't adopt a weaponized notion of national security, that's a very narrow notion of national security. If you Canadians don't adopt a weaponized notion of national security, you will feminize yourself. You will not be real men in the world of international governments. That is a subtext underneath the U.S. government's pressurizing of other governments. That is, who's a real man in the international community, right? Who has a weaponized version of national security? But the other thing that's happened in Canada, of course, is that because of the Supreme Court of Canada declaring that it's unconstitutional for any province to ban gay marriages, you also, in Canada now, must clean up your language and say whether you're talking about heterosexual marriages or same-sex marriages when you talk in a group. So, Massachusetts has now prepared me to clean up my language when I'm in Canada. But that is a very good point that was just raised here. That is, maybe we need to see what goes on in the micro-politics of husbands and wives. A lot of women who are married don't necessarily go into the voting booth voting like a wife. They go in voting like an autonomous person who may or may not be a wife. But some do. And how does that work itself out? Any other hunches as to what's happening here between... Oh, yes. What do you think? Sorry, right here first.
I have a question first.
Yeah, sure.
2% voted were women. And I wanted to know how many percent is that 50% were married and how many percent were married.
Now you know what? I bet we could track this down. It was 54% of all those who voted. Yeah. But you know what? And I don't have those figures. That would really be good to fine tune what we mean by the other. That is, were married women more likely to vote than unmarried women? I mean, one of the things that is going on here and could explain if there are any difference between married women voting or not voting is that one of the economic necessities of being not married in most societies is that you don't have to just have work, you've got to have paid work. And if you have paid work, are you likely to think of security differently? That is, does the very meaning of security get demilitarized? I don't mean totally necessarily. The militarization of security in the popular culture of the United States now is deep. Way deep, much deeper than it is in the Netherlands, much deeper than it is in Japan, much deeper than it is in Canada, much deeper than it is in France. That is, let me do it again, the militarization of what it means to collectively as a country work for security is so deeply militarized in the United States, we really sound different when we talk to each other than do people in the Netherlands, than do people in Japan, than do people in France or Canada. But it may mean that women who have to work for pay have a more broad definition of what security is. That they therefore, when they hear security, they don't necessarily think war on terror. They don't necessarily think who will be my masculine protector. They don't necessarily think of an enemy out there. They're much more likely to think of minimum wage, healthcare benefits, and an unexploitative workplace. And that may change the calculus that they use when they go into the voting booth. So let me end on this and see if we still have a little time for discussion. I'm really worried that our collective, all of us who are making our lives, regardless of what our passport status is, all of us that are trying to make our lives in this U.S. at this time, I'm really worried that we're becoming a shrinking nation. And here's what I mean by that. I'm really worried that our notions of security are shrinking. That is, insofar as the notion of security is being shrunken to the point that what security looks like is mainly a military-based security, that's a shrunken notion of security. And what I'm worried about is that's becoming normalized in American society. Not uncontested, but increasingly normalized. The second thing I'm worried about, and this has to do with shrinkage, I'm really worried that our notion of who is a real citizen, again, don't think passports now, think of how you are seen in the eyes of others and how you see yourself. I'm really worried that the idea of being a full, real, valued citizen is also shrinking because it's getting so closely attached to people who can claim that they've worn the uniform of the government's military. I can't tell you how often I've spoken with sometimes much younger people, and people have come up to me afterwards and said, well, I'm in the ROTC, and I respect that. I want to know sort of why they joined, or they, oftentimes I talk with people and they're in civilian clothes, but they come up and say, well, I'm a reservist, or I'm a National Guard person, or I'm actually in the active duty, but I'm on leave right now. And I'll say, why? What was the appeal? And they will say, because they are oftentimes very altruistic people, and they'll say, because I wanted to sacrifice for my country. Do you see how shrunken it is to imagine that the best way to sacrifice for one's country is to join the government's military? Since when is working in a battered women's shelter not sacrificing for one's country? Since when is not accepting a higher tax burden not sacrificing for one's country? But in American English, sacrificing for one's country has been so meshed with the notion of soldiering that shrinks the notion of country, my, and sacrifice. And finally, I think we are shrinking the notion of the U.S. presidency. You know the term commander-in-chief? Have you noticed how much, and this is right across the party lines, this is us, this is about us, this isn't about Bush. Most of the stuff isn't about Bush. It's not about Kerry. It's about us. Have you noticed how increasingly, and this is particularly since 9/11, but it didn't start there, because you could hear it during the Clinton administration as well, increasingly the main job of a president is to be commander-in-chief, as if that is the essence of a civilian job, not to be the main architect of education, not to be the main thinker and leader in the area of elder affairs, not to be thinking about environment, but to be in the role of commanding a military. Insofar as any of us imagine that the commander-in-chief is the most important line on the job description of the president, we in our heads have militarized a civilian office, the presidency. And then what happens is we then judge any candidate mainly on the basis of that line on the job description. And that militarizes our voting. Thanks a lot, folks.
I want to just take a minute to kind of give those of you who need to leave right now time to do so, and maybe if that empties some chairs. And then we're going to take questions for a few minutes.
Don't worry, you won't get trapped. We'll have a discussion for maybe 10 minutes more. You know?
Just call yourself.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, sure. Let's hear.
I'm curious if you have polling data for single mothers.
Here's the problem with these pollsters, right? even the most reliable pollsters, they only sample about 2,000 and something. Now imagine how small the number is of any, and this is a very interesting category, of not married mothers, right? Which all of us, to try and sort this puzzle out, we'd like to know. Oftentimes that's such a small percentage that in fact they don't feel very reliable about it and they don't even give out the data. But I'll bet in the coming weeks there are going to be more and more fine-tuning of this and maybe sort of post-election surveys that will ask these questions.
Marriage or having a child plays more into the security model thing. That's what I'm...
Yeah, no, I think you're absolutely right. And furthermore, I would like to know whether marriage has any effect on men. Right? That is, do married and unmarried men turn out to vote in this election anyway differently? Or does marriage mainly have an impact on women voters? And I think the single mother thing would unpack this even more. So when you hear the data, email me. Okay? It's a great question. It's a great question. It's a great thing for us to all suss out. Do a mini poll actually in the Santa Barbara area, really, even just to get a hint of it. Would be really pretty interesting. Yes?
I actually have a question.
Sure.
And Aaron, forgive me for asking this question, but could you sort of articulate your concerns with militarization with the discussion about gays in the military?
Sure. No, I mean, I'm being tutored by Aaron in this, so I'm delighted that you asked the question. One of the reasons that Aaron and I have gotten to know each other over the years is because we both are very interested in, concerned about trying to think through the gays in the military, the way it's debated, and how policy is made around it. Now, one of the things that I found myself thinking about a lot is this. How do gay activists who are alarmed at institutionalizing homophobia in one of the United States' most powerful public institutions? Right? That is, if you take in budgetary terms, in policy influence terms, in number of people it hires, the U.S. military, the Pentagon as a whole, but the U.S. military is one of the most powerful institutions in the U.S. society. If it is allowed to, and not only it is allowed to, it is instructed to by civilian elected representatives, otherwise known as Congress, to institutionalize homophobia. That's not like, I'm trying to think of a not very powerful institution. Yeah, well, okay, it is, okay, let's take the Boy Scouts, since the U.S., the American Boy Scouts have institutionalized homophobia. That's bad, but now, you know, so we should object to that, but now magnify that many times over, given how powerful the U.S. military is in American society today. But here's the problem, and that is that a lot of the lobbying, a lot of the effort to persuade not only Congress, but the media and us as the consumers of the media, that in fact the ban on gays in the military is wrong. A lot of the way that gay strategists have gone about this, and I'm very sympathetic with the problem of trying to persuade the American people and Republicans and Democrats in Congress. You know, you have to pull out all the stops. Again, imagine yourself in a strategy session and how you're going to do it. Just think like the suffragists during World War I trying to figure this one out. What I was very worried about in 1992-93 was that the strategy was put up the perfect soldier, put up the perfect citizen so that you could claim that, look, this person is so perfect. This is a person we would all like to think is the ideal of the American citizen. And put that person up to show how idiotic it is, how wrong-headed it is, how mistaken it is to deny that person the right to serve their country. See where my problems are going to come here? It's as if joining the military is the highest way to serve one's country. And that makes me nervous. The second thing is that it's putting up the ideal, and you'll note the gay lobby really searched. They didn't put up any old soldier in front of Congress. They didn't put up any old soldier on Larry King, right? They put up the perfect soldier, the perfect citizen. And what it did is it made an unstated argument that this is the perfect citizen. And that kind of strategy is really fraught to me. One, it idealizes the soldier as the perfect citizen, and it idealizes the perfect citizen as embodied in a soldier, a gay soldier who is not allowed, and then watch the phrase, to serve his country, which then makes it look as though the military is the ultimate place that one can serve one's country. So I really understand the difficulty in this militarized society to make a pitch for ending the ban on gays in the military. I mean, I think it really is wrong-headed and actually quite idiotic. That is, it's not based on any kind of factual evidence, and this is why Aaron Belkin's research here at Santa Barbara is so valuable, because time and time again, Aaron and his colleagues at the center have really shown with evidence that, in fact, all the arguments that are made by the pro-gay ban people, in fact, don't hold water. But I'm really worried about the framing the ending the ban debate in terms of a kind of militarized citizenship that deepens militarization. So I think we're all caught in a bind here, but it is a very risky kind of strategy. And that's my hesitation. And you'll notice this is very much, or you could imagine, this is very much like my thinking about sexism in the military. I work with a lot of women in the U.S. military and people who are advocates of women having a fair shake in the U.S. military. That is, they should be able to rise as far as they can rise, they should not be subject to sexual harassment, and now they should not be subject to rape by male soldiers, which, by the way, is very prevalent amongst American soldiers based in Kuwait. That is, American male soldiers raping American women soldiers. Now, it hasn't made the news, but it's out there. But what I worry about is any casting of that anti-sexism in the military in terms of that's the place where women can best serve their country, or that's the place where you can be a first-class citizen. I think that militarizes citizenship and it militarizes service. But it is very hard in the society trying to talk to the likes of us to find another way to get us to be heard. Yes, please.
Thank you very much for coming. I really enjoyed your talk.
Thank you.
Part of given what you're just saying now, part of what I've been sort of struggling with and trying to figure out with Gary and me are the number of non-U.S. citizens who serve in the military that are given citizenship if
yes.
they die.
Yes.
Right. And so then I was given your talk right now about the perfect citizen. That's also feeding into the perfect immigrant, right?
Yes.
The perfect immigrant who's going to come here, who's going to serve in the military, and then you finally are eligible for citizenship once you die. I mean, at the funeral, you're given citizenship. I mean, I don't know if that's happened before, but I felt like this time around, I have this sort of level, and I don't know if because I live in LA, so they're always showing it on television and the local news.
Oh, that's
the
interesting.
The number of non-U.S. citizens who died given citizenship.
Post-mortem.
Right. I mean, I felt that is feeding into this notion of the perfect citizen, the perfect immigrant, the militarization of citizenship, and all of that, and I didn't know if you could comment on that, or if they were covering.
I think you're absolutely right. The just for the posse over here, the very smart observation here was that in this current multi-headed conflict, it's not just the war in Iraq, the U.S. military has been holding out as a bonus to fulfill their recruitment quotas to people who do not now have U.S. citizenship, that if they are eligible and join the U.S. military voluntarily, that if they get killed in the line of duty, they will be given posthumously citizenship, and that's a very worrisome policy. It is true, back to World War I, that the U.S. government encouraged men at that point, it was mainly men they were encouraging in World War I, to enlist so that they, because remember, World War I was also a time when the United States had a very high proportion of new immigrants, and they encouraged new immigrant men to join the U.S. military during World War I as a way to shorten the time by which they could get citizenship. So this, it's not new, but it's spiked up again. And again, you're right, it militarizes the ideal citizen. It militarizes citizens. And
the military is immigrants. I mean,
yes, and of course, it's happening at a time when because of the Bush administration, now this is particular to the Bush administration right now, because the Bush administration has so stretched the active duty military, the U.S. military is very short of person power. Very short of person power. It's one of the reasons that the elite in the U.S. military, in fact, had such doubts about the fighting of a war in Iraq at the same time as they were still waging a war in Afghanistan. As many of you know, the U.S. military is also in Haiti. It is also in the Philippines. U.S. military is in a lot of places. And it's because they were so stretched thin. So military recruiters, go down to Santa Barbara. Go to any of the towns up and down the California. Go to the valleys, don't just go to the coast. And talk to military recruiters. And one of the things you'll find is that they are under a lot of pressure to meet quotas that they can't meet. And in that setting, they are encouraged, or they then go back up the line and try to encourage the Defense Department to think of new enticements, new things to get people who don't otherwise want to join the military to join the military, either in the reserves of the National Guard or in active duty. The military, this last recruitment round, did not meet their quotas. If you walk by a recruitment office, look in and you'll see a stressed out person, right? And so this is one of several enticements that is put out there to try and meet quotas that otherwise can't be met. Yeah?
I really appreciate your comments about the shrinking notion of security. And those of us who are historians understand that in the 1930s during the Great Depression, we talked about security. And security meant freedom from want. It meant economic security. It meant the original notion of social security. And we know these were fraught and problematic in a lot of ways in their exclusion. But isn't it fascinating? Oh, and I should add, in World War II, Roosevelt had a famous Four Freedom talk. And he talked about then this second round of security as we were winning that war. That were all these freedoms for want and for equity, for health and housing, et cetera. Then we get the Cold War. And this transformation then of this notion of security. But I find it absolutely fascinating right now that as Bush is talking about the ownership society and undoing social security, at the same time that he's talking about security as militarized security. And these are going hand in hand. And I think it's really important for us to see those kinds of connections between what we conventionally think of as domestic policy and foreign policy.
That is Professor Boris, as many of you know, who is a wonderful professor of women's studies here. I think this is absolutely right. And I think it means that we should redefine who is a security expert. One of the things that pals of mine do, right? And sort of one of the things you do as a feminist, you count a lot, right? How many of them, how many of us, you know, you count a lot. And they say feminists, you know, aren't really good at math. It's not true. We count all the time. And one of the things that a number of feminist groups have been doing is keeping track of who is counted as an expert on television news programs. That is, and particularly before 9/11 and after 9/11. And one of the things they found, that if you watch how many women and how many men are invited to be on Ted Koppel, or on the Sunday morning talk shows that none of us listen to, but then we hear the quotes from it all the rest of the week, right? That the striking pattern is the shrinkage, it was never high to begin with, but the shrinkage proportion of women who are invited on because they're seen as having specialized knowledge that can contribute to a public discussion of world affairs. It was never great, it's become even smaller. The other thing they watch, these are really savvy media watchers, the other thing they watch is they watch of all the men and women who are invited, of all the men and the few women who are invited to be experts, how many of them are invited back? And then the gap grows even greater. Maybe a woman has snuck in there, but she's much less likely than the equivalent guy to be invited back because she has been seen to be so effective in talking about world affairs. And one of the things I think is going on there is the definition of who has expertise about national security. If you imagine that national security is, in fact, about weaponry, if you think that national security is about who can talk most authoritatively about moving which battalion where, if you think that national security is about being able to weigh the military contribution of the Pakistan government, then, in fact, you have so shrunken the notion of expertise that it's not that all men will be invited, but very few women will be. And so that the very notion of who knows, who has knowledge about security has shrunk. So the people who know about what it's like to live on the poverty line, they are not considered experts on security now. People who have deep, nuanced knowledge about the growing underclass in the United States, they are not considered experts on security now. So that this question of the shrinkage of security, it also shrinks the notion of who should we be engaged with who has knowledge to talk about the things that we're all concerned about called security. So I think because so many of you here actually have the knowledge about security, that is the things you're studying. You're studying healthcare. You're studying inequalities of income. You're studying what's a decent job and what isn't. That makes you a specialist in security. And I think we really need to redefine security so that many more voices are heard. Yes, Vicki.
When you talk about shrinkage, in terms of shrinking notion and understanding national security and narrowing what constitutes service to one country. I started talking about these distinctions between country and nation and state. And I'm wondering if you think those are important distinctions to keep in mind and what you might have to say about that.
See why she's such a good reader, the viewer. Okay. Now that is a whole four-year education to respond to that, right? But let me put it in a nutshell. A country, a nation, and a state are different, and don't ever use them interchangeably. A country, and even this is a little wobbly, but let's just start here. A country seems to refer to a geographic territory and everybody that's trying to make their life in it. A nation becomes much more, it doesn't have to be, depends how you think of belonging. A nation is riding on the notion of who in that country do you think belongs to something that you think of as a common community. Notice how you can quickly get exclusivist about that. You don't have to be, but you can. Nationalists have oftentimes been at odds also with feminists, even those feminists who try to be nationalists, because the other thing that a nation oftentimes is imagined as versus a country, which is just everybody living their life in a certain geographic region, but a nation is always oftentimes imagined as being a particular set of ideal relationships of the people inside that community of belonging. And for too many nationalists in too many ethnic groups, for too many nationalists in too many societies, for too many nationalists into many places, that ideal society is one where women are mainly supposed to be mothers and wives. That's the main way they're supposed to contribute to the nation. And you find a lot of women in Nicaragua or in the Philippines or in India or in Kenya or in Quebec who say, that's not the nation I want to be part of. I'm not going to work for the creation of a nation that is going to continue to marginalize women. So the relationship of women to nation is usually different than men to nation. And this is why feminist nationalist is one of the hardest things in the world to be. Then the third thing is the state. The state is a hierarchical set of authoritative relationships. A state is what Americans call the government. In most other parts of the world, the state is called the state. But in the United States, we tend to think the state means, I don't know, Nevada. That is, because we are so reluctant in American English to call the state, because it really echoes of authority. And Americans are oftentimes very ambivalent about, even if they buckle under it, by supporting the Patriot Act, for instance, right? Which is a very statist piece of legislation. It empowers the state. But because Americans are very ambivalent about their relationship to public authority, we in the United States, in our discussions with each other, tend not to use the word state. It sounds very European to us. But I think it means that we have a harder time talking about the difference between the nation and the state. And every public figure who can talk about the nation when they in fact are talking about the state is doing us a disservice. Therefore, oftentimes, things that are passed in the name of national security, the security of a community, oftentimes is not national security, it is state security. And somehow, we don't have to adopt European ways of talking about politics, but somehow we have to develop a new American kind of public language so we can call the nation with all its traps so that we keep expanding it, not shrinking it. And we have to distinguish between the nation and the state so that we can see how uneasy that relationship is. And insofar as we recognize how uneasy the state and the nation's relationship is, we are much more likely to be true and valuable and active citizens. Thank you very much.
The recording you have just heard was given by Professor Cynthia Enloe on November 10, 2004, at the Interdisciplinary Humanities Center of the University of California in Santa Barbara. This program was produced by the LA Sound Posse. The LA Sound Posse records speeches and events dealing with social justice issues. We anti-copyright these recordings and share them via the internet, via community radio, and CDs distributed through grassroots social justice groups, nonprofit organizations, committed individuals, and others. Our goal is to be a part of the creation of a broad-based, participatory, and democratic civic media in support of the creation of a truly democratic society. You can reach us on the web at www.lasoundposse.org. Contact us for copies of this program on CD. You can download it for free at radioforall.net. That's www.radio4all.net. If you value what you heard on this program, please feel free to copy and distribute it to others who you think would benefit from hearing it, and thus becoming yourself a part of a decentralized, democratic, civic media.